You're listening to the Yacht Racing Life Podcast, the show for racing sailors everywhere. Featuring exclusive stories and interviews from across the world of competitive sailing. Hosted by British sailing journalist Justin Chisholm. Available wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi everyone, I'm Justin Chisholm, and my guest on this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast is American professional sailor and coach Tom Burnham, who takes us on a fascinating deep dive into the New York Yacht Club American Magic Syndicate's recent challenge for the 37th America's Cup in Barcelona. In our interview, Tom shares his thoughts on the relative merits of the shared reconnaissance program, explains the key elements of his role as the American Syndicate's head coach, describes what goes on aboard the coach boat during a typical training day, as well as giving his assessment of how AC 37 played out between the six teams on the waters of the Mediterranean off Barcelona last summer. All this, plus loads more fascinating insight, makes it an interview that America's Cup fans absolutely won't want to miss. So Tom, thanks for joining me. We saw a lot of each other during AC 37 in Barcelona. I was part of the recon team and you were a regular interviewee target for us. So it's good to get some chance to talk to you in a little bit more time than the 3 minutes we had then.
Yeah, exactly. We only had 3 minutes at the end of each day to have a quick little chat to send out to the people that were watching. So yeah, it's good to see you and good to talk to you again. It's been a few months now, so it's good to catch up after a little bit of downtime.
Let's start with that recon program. What were your thoughts on that whole setup? It was a new introduction by the Kiwis this time around, and obviously I was part of it, so I'm kind of biased, but I'm interested to know your thoughts as a coach.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, this had I'd done a few cups before where that we didn't have this system, and as you said, it was brand new. And at first, it was certainly something that we maybe pushed back against, or it just felt really weird to be supplying a boat, paying for the fuel, and having people inside of our base that were there to spy on us. It just didn't seem right, like to provide those resources for somebody to watch what we were doing and to show it to the rest of the teams. But I think by the end, I think we all got a bit used to it. There were some bumps along the way with some, various personalities that we had coming through. And then some like yourself were really, really great to work with. But overall, I think it was a really good innovation in the sense that it was for sure a lot easier for the teams to not have to go and manage and hire people to go watch other teams and everything. So that was a positive. And then the other piece was it was nice that, you know, we got a consistent product back from all the other teams and saw what the other teams were doing. We couldn't really get that firsthand sort of knowledge or information that we would get from our own employee that was watching, our own team member that was out watching another team. But I think we got a really good product from the recon group, and probably one of the biggest ones is it kept the general public informed, which was a really good thing. I think it was really nice to keep the excitement level of the America's Cup up a bit, even when there's no racing going on, which unfortunately in America's Cup cycles is most of the time that we're in America's Cup, there's no racing, and it's only a short period of time that there is racing. So at least it helps people keep informed throughout the whole process, which is exciting.
Yeah, and I think it transformed that side of things, the non-team side of it, the public-facing bit. And Magnus Wheatley was doing a great job writing daily stories throughout the build-up to the Cup. And in other Cups, we just wouldn't have had anything coming out of the teams because they didn't need to. They weren't obliged to. So generally, they didn't. So yeah, I felt like the interest was a lot higher. And I think with those interviews at the end of each day, I was always conscious that this was the chance for us to give a little insight behind the scenes. As much as we were trying to glean information for the teams, it was also a little window into the team for the general public.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that one of the things that I think it's been the story around the America's Cup for a long time, you know, ever since I've been involved, is I think it's easy to, if you see just the finished product, just the race day, you know, probably especially even later on in the regatta after the first few days are done, I think it's easy to miss how much work it is to get to that stage. And so I think that recon group telling that story of how hard the teams are working, how much effort they put into getting to that place where they can go racing and get around the racetrack in a respectable manner. You know, I think the amount of, you know, mistakes and crashes and capsizes and things that are happening, you know, on a daily basis with the teams. And it was a good story to tell to help, like, just create that background information and have everybody realize that it is a hard road to get to that point where you're racing these boats around the track in a proficient way.
From you as a coach, how valuable was it to get that information? What did you do with it? Was it you or one of the guys or girls who were working for you that would kind of sift through that information?
Yeah, Sean Clarkson, who was also the trimming coach, was really the in charge of the recon program within American Magic, and Sean did a really great job. He loves that all those detail things, and he would sift through daily, you know, hundreds of photos and videos and find the little nuggets and share them amongst the team on our internal Slack channels, and, you know, point things out and ask questions and get people thinking. And, you know, he'd let me know when there was video of pre-start practices from another team, and we'd look and watch what their patterns were and see what they were trying and testing out. And it was a big job. You know, Sean had a lot on, and I think he really liked it. He spent a lot of time in front of a computer screen looking at all these things and trying to figure out what was important and what wasn't. And yeah, it was a really cool process, and it was really nice for the team to be able to have that insight as to what the other teams were up to. You know, you have to be really careful whether you're kind of, I don't know if you're jumping on the bandwagon, but be really careful of how much you let it affect what your priorities are and what your trajectory is, but yet also still be learning from what other teams are doing. So it's a bit of a balancing act as to how much you put in what you see, I guess, from the recon standpoint.
Yeah, I guess the stuff that you might see that's really interesting, but not at that point within your campaign, that you don't want people to get defocused on, you know, at the stage you're up to at that point.
Yeah, exactly. It's easy to derail if you start chasing everything you're seeing on recon and not staying on your path. But yet you also have to be able to adapt when you see something that's innovative or that can change the game. So it's a pretty important job, but what Sean was doing, to be the kind of, you know, everything was always available to every team member. All of the recon, every photo, everything that was coming out was always available to everybody. But at the same time, he would sort of be the gatekeeper in the terms of, you know, trying to share only what was useful, because, you know, you guys sort of had a tendency every once in a while we'd be getting pictures of windsurfers and kiteboarders, and, you know, he had to be careful to make sure we didn't let that stuff sneak into our internal channels and have it waste time, I guess. But it was, you know, there's always lots of stories to be told out there that aren't necessarily about America's Cup. So keeping those out of the recon channel on the Slack was important.
Yeah, I think it was tough for some of the photographers in the group that, you know, they're used to making beautiful images, and sometimes the most practical images. This is one of the biggest things I learned from Ugo Fenoya that I was working with, was, you know, these images don't look pretty when you're looking at a boat from directly behind, but it's really valuable in terms of looking at sail shapes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, for sure. For the photographer, the artistic photographers didn't like it very much in some ways, but it also gave them access to be on the water every day, which was pretty special. So yeah, it was great. It was a good project, and I think it was a good innovation. You know, it'd be interesting to see how that evolves and as we move forward.
What would you change about it?
I think it would be interesting. I don't know if it's, you know, all possible, but I do think that the team having to provide the boat was a bit of a pain in the neck and was hard, but maybe that's just the way it is. And we you know, need to build it in maybe a different way. But, you know, as you had a couple of different boats that you drove two or three different boats during your time with us. And you know, there were some days when it's a pain in the neck and, you know, our boat doesn't work or it's broken or whatever happens. And then, you know, I think that was a one thing that would be interesting if there was a way to have like some sort of the event boats supplied for the recon team, and they could even move around in one day and look at different teams or something. I don't know, but probably not very much. I think it was a pretty successful program, in my opinion.
Yeah, we were always very conscious that the teams would probably have loved to be doing the recon themselves, because it's a control thing. You want to have control over what you're seeing. And I guess maybe you can protect a bit better if it's you're protecting against the other teams rather than, you know, you weren't allowed to hide stuff from us in recon. You weren't allowed to shroud anything and that sort of stuff. So, but I think I always felt that, you know, given how close we were able to get on the water physically to the boat, I mean, it started off at 50 meters was our minimum distance, our closest distance that we could be. Plus the fact we've got professional videographers and photographers recording the footage and taking the pictures, I feel like it must have been better quality imagery and video than it would have been with, say, one of the team doing it whose job perhaps isn't as a videographer.
Yeah, I think that if the recon program hadn't existed, I think you'd have to, you know, it's nice to have a designer or sailor out on the water watching other teams. But having somebody who's a professional photographer, you know, taking the photos and managing the video and, you know, and every day the job that the photographer had to upload all those images and videos every day was a big job and sort through it all. And when you're, you know, you guys were managing one team at a time, and if our team was doing it all the time, we'd have five recon groups out there in theory, if you wanted to follow everybody. And that's a lot of manpower and resources and, you know, for sure it can be really good. Like you say, you can actually say, well, we want to watch this exact thing on this team today and ask that the recon group to go do that, where we couldn't with the joint recon program, that wasn't possible. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see again. I think it was the insight for the public was great. And the way that it was not that difficult for us to manage as a team was a positive as well. So a couple of positives for sure.
Okay, let's move on to working with American Magic. It was a huge organization. I think 120 odd people on the books, if I'm right about that.
Yeah, and it got even bigger when it came to racing, you know, after the one, and probably, you know, with all the hospitality people in there that were helping on the race days and everything, it was maybe 150 or something. I'm not even sure the exact number, but it was definitely a large group. And as I think most of the teams were, really, it's pretty big project, the America's Cup. It's, I think that surprises a lot of people when they come to visit the first time.
That's quite daunting, isn't it? To be in a group of 120 people. I mean, that's a large size company if it was just a commercial operation. I mean, from practical terms, could you possibly know everybody that was working with you in that team?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'd say, like, me personally, I think before it kind of exploded with a lot of people in the hospitality and thing at the things at the end, I think I knew everybody in the team. Maybe there was one or two I obviously didn't know everybody well, but I think I knew everybody's names. And, you know, we'd have lunch all together and have team meetings and things. So, and you'd interact with a lot of the people, probably 80% of the people you interacted with in a fair amount of time. You know, there were some boat builders that might have, you know, maybe in the back corner of the boat building area that were working on special projects the whole time that I didn't interface with enough very often. So didn't know them that well. But yeah, it's a lot of people, and it is hard to get to know everybody. But it's also really amazing to be a part of a program that does have that many people that are all working towards the same goal and have a singular focus. So that's one of the things that's exciting about the America's Cup, and one of the only areas in the sport where you're really in the sailing, where you're really part of an organization that's that large working towards a sailboat race. And so it does take a different skill set to be a part of that. And I think for team members that were their first America's Cup, especially sailors, you know, people that are coming from Olympic sailing, high level Olympic sailing, to be all of a sudden in a squad, you know, 120 people, it's very different than sailing your Laser or your 470 with one or two people and maybe a coach and somebody else. So maybe your whole entire Olympic small program, you know, your program that you have is maybe three or four people. And next thing you know, you're sailing a boat that's got 120 people behind it every day. So it's a different experience and takes some getting used to.
Who did you interact with directly, kind of above and laterally, and I guess, you know, below in terms of the pecking order in there? Who was your group?
Obviously the sailing team, you know, doing the debriefs and being on the water with the sailing team. So, you know, we had a nice big debrief room where the sailors, it was kind of the sailing team home. I mean, that was my office. So I was in there and all, you know, whenever we weren't on the water, and for the most part, most of the sailors were in and out of there and, you know, all day long. So the sailing team, and then obviously Terry with the, you know, running the sailing operations, president of sailing, and then the performance group. So Anderson Reggio and Antoine and Hugo and David Oliver and those guys who are, you know, doing all the performance analysis on a daily basis, the chase boat team, you know, driving the chase boats, working with Dusty and Chaz and Doug and Chris and those guys. And then the design team with Scott Ferguson, but, you know, everybody on a little bit different levels, but primarily sailing team and performance group, I guess, would be the most people I would spend time with and interact with on a daily basis.
You mentioned Slack earlier on. I always associate that with my corporate life before I started in sailing journalism. You guys operated on WhatsApp, I know, a lot, and Slack was another one. Any other communication tools that you used?
Now some email, obviously, as well, too. But those were big. Those were the big ones, really. And, you know, a lot of WhatsApp. It's pretty impressive, actually, how much of our sport gets run on WhatsApp, including, you know, all the messages from the race committee and the race management and all the schedules and delays and communicating with the umpires. All that stuff was happening on WhatsApp on a moment-by-moment basis. It was pretty amazing how much that's become a part of our lives in sailing.
It was funny when the cup ended, all of those groups kind of shut down, and so you're looking at your phone thinking, like, where is everybody? What's happening?
Exactly. Yeah, it's pretty funny how quickly it all goes away at the end of the America's Cup. That's one of the tough things that's really hard, you know, no matter how far you make it through the cup, that you're working and pushing so hard right up until the end, no matter where you are in the game and, you know, what your role is within the event. But you're pushing. And especially if you're one of the teams that, you know, one of the teams that ends up getting eliminated, you leave the dock that morning with the hope that, you know, with the thought that, you know, we're going racing again tomorrow. And then 4 hours later, it's over. And the whole thing shuts down. It's pretty abrupt when it happens. So it's a bit of a harsh reality when it happens, and really tough to kind of manage when you've had so many years of working toward a goal. So that's an abrupt ending. And like you say, all those WhatsApp groups kind of just die out, and, you know, all that kind of goes away. It's pretty weird.
Yeah. I want to get into that moment when the campaign ends in a bit more detail in a second. But let me take you back to the beginning of your time with American Magic. First of all, how did you end up in that coach's role? Who approached you?
I talked with Terry Hutchinson when we were at a TP52 regatta in the fall of 21. So about 3 years ago. And we were at a TP regatta in Mahone in the Balearic Islands. And he asked me if I would consider joining the team. And we talked about it, had a few meetings and discussed it. And, you know, Terry and I had worked together for a long time, and I'd worked with a lot of the people on the team for many years on and off. So he asked me to join the team. And, you know, about a week later or so, I agreed and got into it and started putting together the team. And about a year after that, you know, the October of 22, we started sailing in Pensacola. So it was about a year of sort of getting things organized and set up to be ready to go sailing in Pensacola.
Hi, everybody. Justin Chisholm here with a quick message. We do hope you're enjoying this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. and we wanted you to know that you can get more great content from around the world of sailboat racing on the Yacht Racing Life website, where there's plenty of free content to check out, and premium subscribers get all areas access to the site. Head over to yachtracinglife.com/YRL pod for a lifetime 50% off the regular monthly premium subscription price. So your first move, the first thing you were involved in was picking a sailing team. Because I remember those announcements coming out.
Yep. Yeah. Between myself and Terry, I guess we sort of, you know, he had a few people that he had already spoken to. And then from when I got involved, then I, you know, started consulting with him about the people that were being hired. And yeah, we put together the team and had a couple of design meetings over that period before we started sailing, and some simulator sessions, and just started getting everything put together and in place. Started recruiting the cyclers. We had a couple of little recruiting camps in different places where we flew guys in to put them on bikes and see how they went. And those were fun. We were all also still doing the TP52 circuit and some other racing against each other or with, you know, depending on which team you were on. I was with Michael Menninger for that whole season. So we were working together on one of the 52s and on Interlodge, and Terry was there on the Quantum Racing and with Lucas. And so we were, and I think Tom was also there with Phoenix. So we were able to, and Goody with Gladiator. So during the 52 regattas, we would spend a little bit of time together and start get the team put together. So it was all just a slow ramp up until we started sailing.
When you're looking at the pure sailors rather than the cyclos, what were you looking for? What was the criteria and you kind of set?
Yeah, well, obviously racing skills are a really important part of it, foiling skills, and the ability to fit into a bigger group and be part of a bigger team and be a good teammate. And it's also a bit of a jump to go from a Olympic class or something, you know, sort of smaller boat up to an AC-75 that's pretty technical, obviously, and also a big boat. So having a few people that are in that situation that are making that jump for the first time, but also some experienced people. So it's a mixture of youth and experience, I guess, is really the goal, and good teammates.
Yeah, and you really seem to have done a good job with that in terms of the way the team gelled, certainly in the early stages of it when it wasn't clear who was going to end up on the boat and in the final kind of lineup for the boat. You had a lot of talent coming through. I'm thinking of, you know, Riley Gibbs as a great example, Michael Menninger, who I'd met a long time ago, and you know, I was really happy to see him kind of coming to fruition in an America's Cup team.
Yeah, they were, and you know, all amazing sailors, but amazing people too. And that's the, you know, and Michael really stepped up and did an amazing job during the campaign. Lucas, like, was great. Riley, all the guys did a really nice job, and becoming part of that group that we put together. And then, you know, you add in also the youth and the women's teams that were part of it with us as well, and spent quite a lot of time with us, especially the youth guys that were, you know, just out of college, and or even some of them were taking a year off because they got an offer to come be part of the team. They were still, you know, college students, and to have all those people, you know, see them grow and see them become part of the team and really really gel and learn a lot. It was really fun, and you know, there was a lot of, you know, it's a lot of hard work, obviously, but it's also nice that when you are working with people that you get along with and are happy to spend time with, because it's a pretty long campaign if you're not in that situation. So it is important to, personality is a big thing too.
Yeah, and being able to deal with the size and the scope and the pressure and the workload.
Yeah,
it's not a given. If you were giving advice to somebody who was an aspiring America's Cup team member, maybe not necessarily as a sailor, but shore crew or whatever, just somebody joining the team, what would be the kind of three things you would recommend that they do, or the key things that you would recommend that in terms of their attitude?
Well, it's interesting you ask that, because I was actually just down coaching in Miami about 3 weeks ago, just before the Thanksgiving holiday here in the U.S., where I was working with the U.S. youth team. And I also spent a day with the Olympic development team. And I gave a talk to the youth group, which were mostly, I think, maybe 14 to 17-year-olds. And there was 140 kids there. And I gave a talk about just this. And that my big message was about teamwork and about how working as a group and working as a team is such an important skill when it comes to the America's Cup. And it's something that I think that younger sailors can work on when they are on their way up through the ranks of the sport, so that when they do get to the America's Cup or a TP52 program or any of those types of things, that they're more prepared for that aspect of the game and working within a bigger group. And, you know, one of the harder things too, is if you think about most sailing all the way through, it's pretty rare that you're on a sailing team, you know, be it your 470 or your 49 or whatever, and you might end up as the spare or, on the bench, let's say. So, you know, one of the messages was about how, you know, being a good enough team player, like the guys that we had on American Magic, who, even if they weren't on the boat, were supporting the team and were a real asset to the team and making a difference, even on the days when they weren't sailing or weren't racing. And that's a tough transition for, you know, especially an elite athlete out of the Olympic, out of sailing the Olympics or even just doing Olympic programs, you know, to all of a sudden, you know, okay, I just won a bronze medal in the Olympics, but now I'm on the bench here. You know, it's sort of a bit strange, and it is something that I think that younger athletes can, you know, work on through even being part of, you know, staying and playing soccer through their football through their high school careers, or being part of that bigger group and applying that to their sailing. And then to the extent also of working together as a team in this youth environment of making sure that they're all helping each other to get better and improve, so that the U.S. youth program can be successful out there in the world and be excited about if you don't make the youth world squad, if your teammate that did make the youth world squad goes and wins it, that you've had a part of it and you're a part of it and being proud of your teammate who's gone and won an event that you helped them get there, even if you didn't qualify yourself. So I think that's one of the biggest messages. I think that really would be great for, you know, if a few people take that on and hear it, but hopefully it gets spread a little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a great sentiment and great advice. I just, while you were talking, I was thinking Giles Scott kind of embodied that whole thing, didn't he, with Ineos,
exactly.
You know, I mean, he must have been absolutely devastated not to continue in the helming role, but you never saw any evidence of that.
No, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it takes a real team player to be able to do that. And, you know, and exactly like you say, it looked like Giles was, you know, I don't know intimately, I wasn't in their team obviously, but it certainly seemed like he was a really good team player that was ended up in a position hopefully everybody went into the, you know, goes into them with the mindset that I need to do my best to be on the boat and somebody may take my spot, but no matter how it all works out, be able to still be that good team player and be a part of the team and help push the team along to succeed, even when you're not the one on board is hard. And we say top sailors don't get a chance to be in that role until they get to the America's Cup for the most part, which makes it even harder because it's the biggest stage. It's the thing that you've been working for the whole time. And then now you're finally there and you get put, you know, off the boat, and to still be able to help out and be a part of the team is, you know, that's a tough thing to do. And I give a lot of credit to the guys, you know, certainly looked like Giles was a serious teammate there and did a great job to help that team do well. So, you know, I think it's not an easy position to be in, and it's really impressive to see when people do it well.
there'll be a lot of people listening to this podcast who are aspiring America's Cup sailors, maybe youngsters, maybe not so young, maybe people who are knocking on the door right now. It looks like a really glamorous world to be living in, but I got a really good indication of just how tough life can be as in an America's Cup team. Long days, a lot of work, not a lot of sleep, and not a lot of time to yourself to kind of enjoy life too much over a long period. Can you just talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it's very true. I mean, it is a tough environment. It's pretty demanding. It's stressful. Time is the enemy, so you're always working against the clock, and it takes its toll on your health and your well-being because you are, you know, working so hard. And, you know, even from my perspective as a coach, you know, trying to be ready for the debriefs and working with the performance group. I mean, the performance group guys, those guys were, the hours that they worked, it was crazy. And it's really difficult, but it's really rewarding too. And that's what keeps you coming back for it, because you really want to succeed. And it's such a driver to go succeed in the America's Cup, and being a part of that bigger team is so rewarding. I mean, sure, it can drive you crazy on some days, no question. It could be really hard, but you keep going back because it is, it's pretty rewarding to be part of a group that's working towards the same goal like that, and really pushing and working hard and living that stress lifestyle with you and going through those hard times with you. It really builds a camaraderie that's hard to replace in other parts of the world. So it's a pretty special thing, but it also is really hard. Like you say, it's hard, it's tough. And some days you just want a day off and there just aren't any on the calendar, and that's part of how it works. But yeah, it is rewarding, and people do keep coming back because it is rewarding, even though it's hard work.
One thing I noticed with the American Magic campaign when we were doing recon on you and at other times was that you worked in very structured training blocks. And I always got the feeling that was you that was driving that approach to it. What was going on there?
It wasn't necessarily me that was driving that stuff. I mean, I might've had a hand in it, but it was there's a big group of people that helped steer where the campaign was going. And yeah, there was definitely structured training blocks. Some of it was due to the decision process, you know, when decision in manufacturing. So like for instance, during the foil testing on the AC-40s, you know, the foils had to be designed and manufactured. And then once they became available to use, we only had a certain amount of time to evaluate those foils before we had to make a decision to design the foils for the AC-75. So that led to, you know, specific blocks where we had to test each different foil that came online, and a very hard deadline on when the design had to be submitted for the AC-75 foil. So there were things like that. There were lead times for sales that necessitated different blocks of time. And so really, what, if you look at it, a lot of the whole schedule overall was dictated by those decisions that had to be made for the design process of the new boat. And you could see, if you look at the progression, you know, the first part was a bit of sort of hull shape and systems things, and then it was foils. And then once the foil decision was done, then it was into sails, because the sails were the things that were quickest to build. And then once we were through the sail, sort of major part of the sail design process of testing, you know, we were into a racing period before the new boat launched. And you know, of course, there were other things going on in there, and you know, some sales stuff happening on early on and things like that. But if you kind of majority break it down into the different zones and sectors of the campaign, those were kind of more mostly driven by design decision timings than really anything else, which was, you know, it's obviously how I would imagine most of the teams have done that. And also building in time to be modifying and maintaining the boats as well.
Teams had a choice: use the AC-40s, use a legacy AC-75, or build an LEQ-12. You did a little bit of a combo of two of those options with the AC-40s for foil testing, and then
bringing back Patriot, the original Patriot kind of version two, I would say. Happy with that, with those choices still now, or is there a bit of you that would have liked to have gone LEQ12?
No, I think it was good. I think it was good for our team to do it as we did. I think, you know, I mean, you look at the two teams that ended up in the finals, you know, Team New Zealand was the same sort of program that we had, and then INEOS and Lunarosa, which were another couple of top teams, never sailed an AC-75 and did an LEQ and an AC-40. So there was kind of a couple different ways to skin the cat. And I think what we did was the right thing for us and our decision-making at the time. And, you know, it'd be interesting to think about how you'd structure it in the future. But I think for where we were with at the beginning of the campaign and what we needed to do, I think it was really valuable to sail the AC-75 straight away. Our first thing, you know, we had a lot of newer people to these kinds of boats. So getting them time on the boat and working on some of the systems and just learning how to operate an AC-75 was really valuable. And then the AC-40s turned out to be a really great tool. You know, maybe there were some scaling things that could have been a little bit different with an LEQ, but at the same time, the process of, you know, building and designing and building an LEQ, I mean, it's not that far off what you had to go through for an AC-75. And, you know, on our time horizon, I'm not sure that would have worked as well as what we did with the 75 and the 240s.
There was quite a lot of talk that at the previous cup, the original Patriot was one of the faster boats in the tournament. It didn't end up that way for reasons we all know.
Mm. Yeah. And it's right. And it was a great tool for the team, and the shore crew and designers did a really good job of modifying it so that we could learn some things leading into the Patriot for the AC-37. So yeah, it was a great boat and a good tool to use, and getting that sense of scale and sailing a 75 at scale for when we had quite a new sailing team, really. There weren't that many people that were over from the last campaign, really. Goody and Andrew Campbell were the main sailors that came back from the campaign before. And so to have that time in the 75 early on, be able to have the input from the sailing team into the new design of the new boat was pretty valuable, I think. I thought that was good.
You bring up that, you know, new sailors, new to the AC-75. I remember a day on the water getting a call on the radio from you that we were kind of a little too close at the windward mark and you know, asking us to move. And afterwards you said to me, you know, we're not race ready yet. Like, if we were race ready, you'd have been fine where you were, but we're not convinced we've got full control of the boat, you know, bearing away at speed around the top mark. And it really struck me that day, because you kind of imagine that these guys just know how to do it, but there was a learning curve they were on.
Oh yeah, there was a very big learning curve. I mean, that's the thing that I think it was great about the recon group being there, is they're really hard to sail. They're really hard to sail well, especially, but they're hard to sail just in general. And yeah, that was my, you know, I just didn't, you know, they are hard. And sometimes you might be a little bit out of sorts and you just have to wait 3 more seconds before you can bear away because you've got a little bit too much leeward heel or whatever it is. And yeah, it brings to mind, I remember that moment exactly. And, but it also brings to mind a little bit about the amount of spectators that we had out watching. The excitement level of people in Barcelona was great, but it also is scary because they see the boat sailing and see the boat sailing well and don't quite realize that it's not that hard for things to go wrong. I mean, it's a delicate thing and it's really hard to do well. So yeah, it is interesting how on the race days, the boats look pretty good. I mean, obviously there were some mistakes made, but not too bad. But when we were out training, especially early days, there's mistakes. It's part of the deal.
Tom, you've been involved in a lot of AC campaigns over the years. Just in general terms, what are the big differences you've seen in the makeup of these teams now from those early days with the kind of conventional monohull race boats through the cats and up into these incredible foiling AC75 monohulls?
Yeah, the biggest one, it's an interesting one because, you know, my first cup was the 30th AC in 2000 down in Auckland, New Zealand. And so I started sailing on a cup boat, on a cup program in 97. And probably the biggest change is the shift in the sort of amount of people in the different departments on the team. And it went from being quite a sailing team heavy programs with enough people for two boats with 17 people on each boat plus a couple of spares. So we had 35, 36 sailors on the sailing team to be able to go out and do two boat testing and racing on the ACC boats. And then IACC, I guess they were called. And then probably a similar number of people on the team, 100 to 120 people, but so many more sailors compared to these days. Like, you know, now there's less than half that, or, you know, 15, 16 people on a sailing team, including the cyclers, the power group, and the shore crews and the design teams have gotten bigger. So that's probably the biggest shift and how we, as the sailors, were able to work with the shore crew more and be more involved in the maintenance and upgrades on the boats than now. I think now the boats have gotten very technical and very specialized, and the people that maintain them are amazing technicians and really smart men and women who know their field so well that, you know, if we got involved, it's probably a bad idea. So it's the sailors are trying to stay away, and the sailing has gotten harder as well. So the sailors are spending time in the simulator and in the debrief room more than in the past as well. So there's less time for the sailing team to be involved with the maintenance of the boats also. So there's definitely been a shift in that regard as to how the teams are set up.
I remember we would arrive at the base kind of 10 minutes before rollout was scheduled, and the rig would go in, the boat would get dropped in the water, and then everybody would kind of disappear, and this team of people with laptops would come and literally plug into the boat, and suddenly the foils would start going up and down, the mast would rotate a bit, whatever it was they were testing. And this was the daily routine to get, and it was probably 2 hours, I would say, it took to get the boat ready to go sailing.
Yeah.
Did you understand everything they were doing?
Oh, no way. No. Definitely didn't understand it all. No. I mean, I think I knew, we all understood, for the most part, all of the different sequences and things that would happen and different button presses and everything, but how they made it all happen, no way. There's no chance. That's, you know, stay in my lane. That's not my lane at all. And it is. There's a lot of programming and computer work that has to go into all that. And a lot of that safety was as well. I mean, if you think about your standard boat, you can put the mainsail up and kind of cruise your way out to the start line while you're having a sandwich. But on these boats, once the mainsail's up and you're going, there's no half speed. So once you're up and running, especially in Barcelona, if you think about how we would go out and we'd hoist in the channel there out on the breakwater, in the southerly, the very first thing was you'd take off on starboard tack and you'd do a bear away at 50 knots. And so if you push the button and the rotation went the wrong direction, you're straight into a 50 knot nosedive or something. So making sure that everything works on the dock and is safe and ready for use before we leave the dock was crucial for safety and for performance. So it's there's a big checklist that the team had to get through every day before and after sailing to make sure that, you know, we were performing well on the boats, was doing what it was supposed to do, and also that it was safe for the guys to be on board.
Are you interested in advertising your product or service on the Yacht Racing Life podcast? It's really simple. Go to yachtracinglife.com/advertising to find out how.
One of the things I was always really jealous of was that you guys all had your communication headsets on and you were talking to the boat. You could hear what was going on. It was just, You know, we were outside of that loop completely. So we had to try to work out what was going on and try and be in the right place for it all, try and keep up after the 50 knot bear away.
Yeah.
Can you kind of describe for people listening what a typical day was like on the water on the chase boat?
Yeah. And to your point about the comms units, that's another innovation I probably should have mentioned when you asked about the makeup of the team. But it's really since, well, for me at least, Bermuda, I'm sure in San Francisco, the comms units were pretty good, but it's so good as the coach to be able to hear and to communicate with the team in real time that it really makes a huge difference to be able to help the team. I'm a big fan of listening to the comms. And even when I'm coaching other teams now, I'm constantly looking for a solution where I can hear what's happening live so that I can have better feedback, because it's really hard sometimes from the boat, just like you say, to from outside watching, to give much feedback when you don't hear like the talk of boat feels backloaded, or you know, there all the little things that just like any other boat that people talk about, there's too much windward helm or there's not enough windward helm. And you know, you can look at, hear that calm, hear those communications, and then look and like, oh, let's pull the jib lead in a little bit, or there's lots of little things that you can pick up from the communication. So that it was a huge part of it, and no question, it was a lot harder on you guys to not have that. And you know, obviously we weren't going to give you our comms units to come be the recon, but that's it's a game changer in for coaching. So it's been a real big help for us. Onto the sort of the day in the coach boat, you know, we would leave the dock and we'd already have our plan of the day and we'd be ready of what our goals were for the day. And, you know, hopefully the weather would cooperate and what we set as our goals, you know, we'd be able to accomplish. But it was kind of keeping the boat and the team on track with the goals, you know, working with the performance boat, the performance team over on Chase 2 to make sure that we were achieving what we needed to achieve and they were logging the data that they needed to log and we were achieving the sailing goals that we wanted, communicating with the team, you know, even while they were sailing, like, you know, they'd ask a question, we'd answer the question from the chase boat, looking at hull clearance or, you know, what a sail looked like, giving feedback as to how the leech looked or whether the main and jib were set up the same tack to tack and, you know, all the things you would do in a normal sailboat coaching as well. And then, getting the timing for the starts and practice races. And it's not so different to what you would do in a normal coaching role on a normal team. And, you know, down to being the lunch boat and the water boat, and the boat would stop and we'd tie up alongside and, you know, make sure the guys were hydrated and fed, and especially the cyclers who were working really hard. Those guys needed to be, you know, maintained physically, and we would organize be texting on WhatsApp with the group on shore and making sure their timing of getting the rotation, the guys to come out from on shore to rotate in to give the guys a break halfway through the day. And so it's kind of a lot of managing the different channels and making sure the day hopefully stayed a bit on target, and then also giving feedback and coaching. So pretty busy, yeah. But and the long day hanging on at 50 knots, as you know well, is also that. Yeah, it was spent some time with the physio trying to make sure my back didn't break as well.
Yeah, my back is just about sorting itself out after 2 years of that. But Barcelona, just on that, Barcelona conditions were, you know, everybody talked about the waves and the wind state. On certain days when the wind was out of the south, you could have some beautiful flat water that was, you know, the same as Bermuda or Auckland. And then other days, this kind of awful side swell, steep wave, waves going against the wind, all sorts of stuff. It was a very different venue, wasn't it?
It was. It was a very challenging venue, but you know, and it was. There was a lot of difficult conditions. There were some amazing days, some glamour days. I think the September of 2023, the year before the cup. Wow, I remember that. We had like 2 weeks straight of these amazing sea breezes of like 15 to 18 knots with flat water every day. Beautiful sunshine. It was just spectacular. And So yeah, it was a really tricky venue in the sense that it threw a lot at you, waves and wind and waves and no wind and flat water. And, you know, a lot of different conditions came at you, which in a lot of ways was really good and pretty daunting for the sailors and the designers alike to, you know, most foiling boats really don't perform that well in sea state. And it was definitely hard. But I think in the end, the sailors were able to manage it pretty well. The guys and girls were able to handle it pretty well. And, because we had to, but overall also, you know, we were there for 18 months and we didn't miss that many days due to weather, not whether it was light, too light or too windy, or it was pretty good. It was impressive how frequently we were able to sail even through the winter months. You know, we had to go hunting for the wind a little bit and out to the airport area and things like that, but we didn't get skunked by the weather that often, probably less than I was expecting. We had more sailable days than I think we expected when we were going there, especially through the winter.
Yeah. And I think once the racing started, because I've been telling people that story and saying, oh, we didn't lose very many recon days due to the weather.
Yeah.
Of course, then we had all sorts of thunderstorms and no wind, yes, and too much wind. And it's not normally like this here, of course.
Yes. Exactly.
It's the message.
Yeah, I mean, exactly. Just like I was saying before, the year before in September of 2023 was just spectacular. And then September of October of this year was a little more tricky. So it certainly provided some great racing still, but it was not necessarily as advertised.
When all the teams arrived finally in Barcelona and the Kiwis were there too, it was spectacular. And the recon period kind of finished mysteriously at the time that the Kiwis arrived. The recon period finished, but we'll forgive them that little advantage that they gave themselves. But just watching from the shore, it was just spectacular to see these boats. But for you guys, you must have been one eye on your boat and then one eye on the other teams as well, trying to assess who looked good in what conditions. And there were definitely times when one team would look great, and then the next day they'd look terrible. Yep. Is that how you saw it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, there were tendencies. Teams would run a little bit hot and cold, but for the most part, everybody stayed pretty true to form, and everybody did really well in the lead up, and teams were quite even. And you know, it was interesting. We weren't allowed to race against other teams. We weren't allowed to line up with other teams. But within that, there were some things we could do, like we could sort of duck one another and cross tacks and go 30 seconds or a minute opposite tack and come back and cross each other again. And so there were a lot of those sort of informal, let's call them races, I guess, where they weren't coordinated, but one boat would duck another. And next thing you know, we'd end up doing crossing tacks with another team for 4 miles upwind. And it was fun. It was really good for the teams to get that chance to do that. And we were able to glean a little bit of information from those moments and times, but it was hard to keep focused on what your projects were and your goals of the day were when next thing you know, one of the teams tries to duck in and get in next to you or vice versa. If we would do that with another team, you know, it was easy to kind of slide off into that instead of sailing by yourself, which isn't as much fun as crossing tacks with another team.
And was it always like that? Just somebody would come sidle up and kind of join in? Or I always imagine there was some sort of WhatsApp, you know, we might be going at wind at this time on.
There may have been a little bit of that here and there, but it was mostly, it was interesting too, because sometimes even you talk to some of the other coaches or people afterwards in the evening, if you'd run into somebody on the bike ride home or whatever, and like, oh, I was trying to keep them away from you guys, but we couldn't stop them on the boat. And next thing you know, they were ducking and you guys were into a, you know, doing a full lap up and down with crossing tacks and crossing jibes, but we wanted them, you know. So it's that competitive spirit that these guys all have, and that we all have in the coach boat too, that let's get into it. It's way more fun than sailing around by yourself. That's for sure.
I know that's true because I had a beer with Goody at some point during that period. And I said, oh, it looked amazing out there on the water with all the boats today. He's like, oh my. He said, that was just so much fun.
Yeah.
So much fun. He said, once you can duck another boat, it just changes everything, you know?
Exactly. So. Yeah, it definitely was good. And it's good for the team too. You all, the next thing you know, you're working on, you're looking at another boat and can we cross them? Can we leap out? Do we have to duck? You know, all those decision-making and looking at the situation was valuable for the racing period as well. So, you know, it was hard to not go do that. That's for sure.
Tom, when you look at across the teams now, looking back with a bit of distance and a bit of perspective, do you think the teams all performed as you expected them to in terms of, I don't think it was any big surprise that the French were the first ones out because they had less time. Mm. You know, I personally feel if they'd been fully funded earlier on in the whole process, they would have been a pretty potent force at some point. But just looking at those other teams, do you feel like it went the way you expected it to?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was hoping that we would go farther for sure. And, you know,
yeah.
Kind of expecting that, you know, I wouldn't say expecting it, but working towards us going farther. I think we did pretty respectably and did okay. And, but yeah, I guess it was probably about how you'd expected it. Maybe the Ineos team, the boat was so radically different to everybody else's that it made you wonder, you know, if ours or Team New Zealand's boats, which were pretty small and Luna Rossa as well, like we were all quite small boats and, you know, were right. How could that one also be right? And it was, you know, they did a good job. And so they probably, and also in some of the preliminary stuff, you know, maybe they exceeded the expectations of some people for sure. You know, Luna Rossa, they were a strong team all the way through. So kind of expected them to make it through a little bit further. But, you know, I think we all knew and we all expected as well that this cup was going to be closer. And I think it did prove to be closer. And I think it really came down to, you know, Team New Zealand did a really nice job of working on their maneuvers and their tacking and specifically was really strong and it allowed them to, you know, and they were sailing the boat really well. You could hear on their comms that they were mostly talking about sailboat racing. They weren't talking about how to sail the boat and they were, you know, tacking really well. And that's a huge part of it. The boats are spending 30 to 40% of the time of a race off optimum speed and either accelerating or decelerating. So if you can make that go from 38% to 35%, you know, that's a big gain. And I think they seem to do just that. And, but in reality, all the sort of straight line performance was pretty similar across the board in all the teams. And, you know, the French, like you say, they were getting stronger and stronger every day. We certainly wouldn't have wanted to have, it would have been a lot harder to beat them a week later. You know, every day that they sailed, they improved. So they're a really strong team and we're definitely a contender and they're just probably their lack of time is what made it hard on them. But with a little bit of time, they're a tough team. So it would all come down to the day. Every day, a different team could be strong. I think it was pretty impressive.
Yeah. I thought it was a great cup all in all, because there was so much uncertainty as to who was going to end up in the final. And I think quite a lot of people were surprised that the Brits, you know, made it through. I think an Italy, New Zealand final was what most people were expecting. So from that point of view, I think it's great. How many of these teams do you think we'll see back in the cup, in the next cycle of the cup?
That's a great question. I hope all of the teams that were here will be able to do it. It sort of seems like all of the teams are working towards being back again. As far as I know, I haven't heard any different. I think American Magic is hoping to be back and working that way. And I think the other teams are as well. And, you know, hopefully we'll get one or two new teams. That would be great. So yeah, I'm hopeful that all these teams will be back. I think everybody that was involved in this past cup has a really good platform to start on and to work from. And, you know, that's the real game is if you can, the building up that knowledge over a couple of campaigns makes a huge difference. It's a really tough game to come in and do your first time and do well. And being able to build upon the successes and the learnings of each campaign is crucial. And, you know, so I think all these teams have a great place to start from to work towards the next one.
It's brutal when the team gets eliminated from the cup. Being the first one out, I guess, is the worst thing, but it's as each fall by the wayside, it's terrible. From your personal experience this time around, how did the team deal with that? What was it like the day after the dream was over?
Yeah, it was hard. I mean, it's definitely it was difficult to wake up the next day. And, you know, if I remember correctly, I don't think we worked the next day. I think we had the next day off, and it was hard. And, you know, we really, the majority of the team only worked another week after we were eliminated, and that was it. And some people were, you know, there were even some people that left within a day of us being eliminated. There were guys getting on planes and leaving, and people getting back to their families in different parts of the world. And yeah, it's a pretty brutal, it's a pretty harsh ending, and it's tough. And it's pretty much the same for everybody. I think even Nathan, I listened to a podcast with Nathan Otteridge after, and even for the guys that won it, that was a harsh reality the next day when they go into the base and see all the computers already packed up and the boat getting taken apart. And it's really a bit surreal when you spend 2 years building towards one thing, and then one day, the next, it's all in take apart mode and dismantling, and it's a lot to dismantle, and, you know, the logistics of moving everybody out of Spain and back to their homes, and, you know, all that went into it, from the admin group and the team of cleaning out apartments and getting containers and organizing shipments all around the world and airplane tickets for everybody. And it's a real project, and it's like this whole nother phase of the campaign just kicks in from one day to the next. And really, it's a real sort of shock to the system when it all of a sudden goes from being a sailing focused team to being a, you know, demobilization team. It's quite a shift that happens overnight.
What's the protocol at that point? Does the whole operation shrink down to a kind of skeleton crew now, or are you still on the books with them, or no?
No. I think it's a pretty small group now that are working, you know, working towards keeping the campaign going and working towards the next campaign. You know, I'm not on the books per se at the moment. I'm, you know, working a bit and helping out and doing a few things here and there, but mostly taking some time off and getting into some other sailing projects and coaching for this coming season and see where it leads to. And, you know, we'll, you know, hopefully be back and up and running in a little while if the team decides to carry on and go forward. So yeah, we'll see how it all plays out.
Has there been the inevitable debrief at this point? Does that already happen?
Yeah. Well, one of the first things we did was sort of debriefs and things right after the cup ended, in that first period straight away, while it was fresh in everybody's minds and before everybody is, you know, physically leaves. We thought that was a good time to do it. And there's been some, you know, a couple of surveys that have gone out to the group, broader team. And, you know, there's a lot of small group debriefing happening and phone calls and chats with team members and teammates and lessons learned. And, you know, I've got a couple of different pages of notes in different various places that something I'll be, you know, sitting having a coffee and something will come to mind, or, you know, watching a video. And, you know, it's a lot of information. And so it takes a little while to process everything and come up with all the different thoughts and ideas that we have individually, and then hopefully gather the best information from the wider team as well, so that the team has the most info to move forward with.
Losing Goody, Paul Goodison, with the injury must have been a massive blow. How much do you think that impacted the success of the campaign?
Yeah, it was really hard. You know, obviously Goody is a major part of the team and helming the boat. And yeah, that was really difficult. It was really tough. It was, you know, Lucas stepped up and did an amazing job, but it's, you know, but Goody was, you know, part of the program from day one and one of the senior leaders of the team. So losing him definitely had an impact. And, you know, it's hard to quantify exactly how that impacted the team. You know, it's, you know, I would definitely say that, you know, that Lucas stepped up and Tom did it, and Lucas and Tom and Michael and Andrew Campbell did a really good job of helping Lucas integrate into the team and be on the boat for that series that came up right after and against Lunarosa. And, but it was definitely a difficult moment for the team. And, you know, again, speaking about that, you know, what we were talking about earlier about teammates being good teammates, you know, as soon as Goody was able to get back into the office, he was in the debriefs. And, you know, even when he was at home still recovering, he was on the Zoom call. Every time we had a meeting, he was calling in and sending notes and being a part of the process and being part of the team to help Lucas and to help the team in general. And, you know, he really was a great teammate for that period after he got injured. And it's a tough moment, and you know, it's something, it's really hard to watch how that one split second moment could affect so much. And at the same time, it was also really great that we had somebody as amazing as Lucas that was there on the chase boat and being a great, you know, being a big part of the team and working so hard day in and day out when he wasn't racing, that he was up to speed enough to jump on the boat and do a good job sailing the boat. So it takes a big effort from everybody on the whole team. And, you know, and those guys specifically did a great job to, you know, help and be a part of the process, whether they were on the boat or not, and really keep pushing the team forward.
Yeah. Lucas, I think, impressed everybody. He at the end, on the day that you guys were eliminated, we interviewed him. I was working as part of the America's Cup media team. And in the middle of the interview, Jimmy came over and just said, "Lucas, I couldn't be more impressed with what you've done, you know, stepping in like this." And Lucas, who had been holding it together until that point, was just, that was it. Like, he was gone. There was tears, you know, the whole thing. So I think he really did do a good job, because it's like a quarterback, like a reserve quarterback being called in at, you know, unexpectedly, right?
Yeah, no, it's exactly right. I mean, you're all of a sudden, he's going from sitting next to me on the coach boat to, you know, being the leader of the team on board the boat. And it's, you know, he's an Olympic medalist and, you know, done a few Olympic games and been a part of a lot of really successful programs in the past. And so he had the ability and had the skill set and he was able to jump in and do it, but it's also still a lot of pressure. It's a big moment, and to have it happen like that is really hard, where, you know, even that day when the afternoon Goody got hurt, it was like, you know, we were still out on the water and Lucas had to jump on board and steer the boat back to the dock on the tow. But still, like, was like, all right, this is real. You know, we tell you to, you know, he kept his sailing gear on board the chase boat every day and never really had to use it. And then that day, next thing you know, he never took it off again. So it takes a special person to be able to step up and jump into a role like that. And Lucas really did an amazing job.
Yeah. I'm hoping to persuade him to join me on the podcast at some stage, and Goody also as well.
Yeah.
It's been lovely chatting with you. Let's just round it off with what's next for you. You talked about some other sailing projects. What can you tell us about those over the coming 12 months?
Yeah, the next few months, I'm going to be still doing some coaching. I'm going to get back and do some coaching in the RC44 fleet, similar team that I was involved with before. It's a new team, sort of an offshoot from the Artemis Racing program. And so a new team that's joining the circuit starting in the event in February. And so I'll be with them for the season. And, with a few interesting characters on the boat, that'll be fun, and everybody will recognize when the team gets announced. And then doing a bit of sailing on one of the 52s here in the U.S. and some coaching in Newport over the summer and some of the other boats, and maybe a little bit of sailing in Newport as well, and trying to be home a little bit more than I have been the last couple of years. I've got my son's last summer of before he goes off to college, so he's big into sailing. So I really enjoy being able to be involved with his sailing as he's getting older and, you know, taking him to foiling week this winter down in Pensacola. And he's really getting into it. So Leo's doing a great job with that. And my daughter will be back home from school for the summer as well, at least for part of it. So it'll be nice to be a little bit more local than I have been the last few years.
That all sounds fantastic. I'm delighted you're going to get some of your own sailing as well as coaching, because I know you still love to race as much as ever.
Yeah.
Tom, thanks so much for taking the time and joining me. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Great to talk to you. It's been a pleasure, and been good to catch up, and hope we doesn't take as long as next time. It's been a few months since we've seen each other, so it'll be good.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Life podcast. We will be back soon with another top name interview, but in the meantime, check out yachtracinglife.com for more great content from across the sailing world.